Yeah, so first of all, thank you all for having me here, particularly thanks to Katie for inviting me. So as Katie mentioned, I'm currently a student at MIT in my fifth and final year. And I'm excited to be telling you guys about some recent work that I've been doing, looking at probing exotic energy injection using observables such as the cosmic microwave background, as well as early star formation. So this is work I did together with these wonderful collaborators, Hongwan Liu, Julian Munoz, Greg Ridgway, who has since left physics, and then also my advisor, Tracy Slyer. So just to give you guys a little bit of an outline so you know where I'm going to go with this talk, I'll start by motivating this project a bit before talking about the main tool that I use for this work, which is called Dark History. And then I'll tell you guys about some of the fun physics applications that you can do with this tool, including looking at CMB spectral distortions, as well as the effect of dark matter on these distortions, looking at CMB anisotropy constraints on light-dark matter, as well as the most recent work, which came out this past August, looking at how dark matter can affect the formation of the earliest stars. Okay, so let me just give you a little bit of background to make sure we're all on the same page. I'm going to start by outlining some of the most important epochs in our universe that we'll want to keep track of. So very early on in our universe, we know that everything was very hot and dense and ionized. However, as our universe expanded and cooled, eventually recombination occurred, and what we were left with was just this dark neutral hydrogen sitting around, not doing a whole lot of anything. Eventually, this hydrogen was able to collapse and form the very first stars. We think this happened around redshift of 15 to 30. And then these stars emit radiation that then re-ionizes our universe, and then structure continues to form until we get the modern galaxies that we see today. So this whole picture of our universe's evolution is very well explained by the Lambda CDM standard cosmological model. However, there are some details that Lambda CDM still doesn't necessarily provide for us. For example, it doesn't tell us what is the fundamental nature of dark matter. It doesn't tell us if dark matter can have interactions other than through gravity, since that's how the only way we've observed it. And any detection of such an interaction would be, you know, absolutely huge. So that's pretty much what I work on. I like to think about how the dark matter microphysics can imprint on any of the observables that we've discussed here. So specifically for this talk, I'm going to be focusing on what I call exotic energy injection. So by this, I mean energy that gets injected into electromagnetic observables, but by processes that aren't readily explained by Lambda CDM or the standard model of particle physics. So throughout this talk, I'll focus particularly on the example of decaying dark matter. But these results can be generalized to your favorite model of exotic energy injection. A lot of the other ones that people look at include annihilating dark matter, as well as evaporation or accretion by primordial black holes. OK, so this is a question I often get from the particle physicists, which is, what is the model you're looking at? What is your Lagrangian? The nice thing about exotic energy injection is that we can study it in a relatively model-independent way, by which I mean you only need to specify a few parameters, such as the redshift dependence of the rate at which energy gets injected into our universe, as well as the spectrum of primary particles you get from these interactions. The reason for this is because if I had, for example, like an axion that decays into photons at a particular energy, or if I have some other particle physics, new particle that decays into photons at the same energy, the effect on the universe is going to be the same, right? So I don't need to specify the exact UV model. OK, so then for the example of decaying dark matter, the parameters that we care about are the dark matter mass, since this controls the energy of the photons that we get from these primary interactions, as well as the interaction rate and decay lifetime, since this controls the rate at which energy is injected. And then for this talk, I'll focus on specifically decays to electron-positron pairs, as well as photons, since injections into other final states can usually be understood qualitatively in terms of these results. All right. So let's think a little bit about how exactly exotic energy injection can imprint on different observables in our universe. So there's going to be a lot of different processes we have to keep track of. So I'm going to start with the simple example of a single dark matter particle, let's call it chi, and say it decays into a pair of electrons and positrons. Depending on what the mass of the dark matter is, these electrons and positrons could be very energetic and deposit that energy in a number of different ways. For example, these particles could thermalize with existing charged particles in our universe, thus depositing that energy as heat. These electrons could also collide with atoms in our universe, such as hydrogen or helium, and then excite these atoms. And then when these atoms de-excite, they're going to emit line photons that we can then try to look for on top of background radiation. These electrons could also upscatter CMB photons, giving you very high energy photons that you could look for. This will also distort the CMB spectrum. That's not the end of the picture for these photons. If they have a high enough energy, they could then go on to ionize atoms like hydrogen and helium. Ionizations could also be caused by collisions with your primary electrons and positrons, and then the secondary electrons resulting from these ionizations could undergo all of these processes all over again. So as you can see, if we want to track the effect of exotic energy injection on properties such as the background temperature of our universe or the level of ionization, as well as the spectrum of background radiation, it's pretty non-trivial to track these cascades in enough detail to say anything accurate. But luckily for you guys, such tools have been developed. And so the one that I have been involved with developing is this dark history tool. So you can download dark history at GitHub at this link. And so in its original iteration, what dark history does is it calculates the global temperature and ionization histories of our universe while self-consistently including models for exotic energy injection. And so as of March of this year, we released Dark History version 2, where we made some major upgrades such that you can now also calculate the evolution of background radiation. So some of the things we had to change in order to make this possible in Dark History was we had to improve how we treat the energy deposition by low energy electrons, as well as adding a lot of new machinery to track hydrogen levels. So I'll go into a little bit more detail in a second about why these improvements were necessary. If you're interested in reading more about this yourself, those upgrades are described at the first archive number. And then for the later part of my talk, where we talk about the interesting physics applications, you can also read about those details at the second paper listed here. Okay. All right, so let's talk a little bit about why these upgrades were necessary for tracking things such as radiation. So previously, in dark history, the way we tracked electrons was we first divided them into two energy regimes, one which we call high energy. This is for electrons with kinetic energy greater than 3 keV, and then low energy electrons. So how do we track how high energy electrons deposit their energy? Well, if we think about some electrons starting with energy E prime, we can fairly easily calculate how much energy gets promptly deposited into some channel by just knowing what is the cross-section for that particular interaction, as well as the number density of targets. So that's the prompt energy deposition represented by PC. And then some of these interactions will also produce spectra of secondary electrons. So that means if I want to know how much energy gets deposited into a particular channel, such as heat or ionization, after the electron has cooled completely and lost all of its energy, let's call this R sub C, then that's given by the prompt deposition plus the energy deposited into that channel by all of your secondary electrons, which is also controlled by this R sub C function. So now you have this equation that you can solve recursively to determine how electrons deposit their energy. For low energy electrons, we did something a little bit different. We instead used the results of MEDEA, which is a Monte Carlo-based method to track energy deposition. In other words, you just simulate electrons bouncing around, scattering by these different processes, and see how much energy ends up in these different channels. A couple disadvantages of using MEDEA. For low energies, we only had results for electrons at those six different injection energies. So if you wanted to use the results for any other value, you had to do a pretty coarse interpolation between these values. And then the other disadvantage is that MEDEA does not give you spectra of secondary photons. So if you want to track something like how radiation evolves, it's insufficient to just know how much energy ends up in photons, right? You need to know the spectrum of secondaries. So that was one reason why we couldn't do this with dark history before. However, in principle, our high energy treatment should apply at all energies, right? There's nothing I described in this treatment that clearly breaks down at any energy. The reason we couldn't do it before is because there were some approximations made in the cross sections that we used, such that we didn't necessarily trust the results at low enough energies. And then also by dividing the electrons in this way, we could allow users to implement their own model for low energy cooling if they felt they had a better model. All right, but again, as of March of this year, we did a bunch of upgrades, including upgrading the cross sections we used, which now allows us to extend our high energy treatment down to arbitrarily low injection energies or dark matter masses. So we've cross-checked our treatment against a number of other codes, including MEDEA. And so you can see the results here. So on the y-axis, we have the fraction of the electron's energy that gets deposited into a particular channel, which is represented by these different colors. And this is as a function of the background level of ionization. So the dark history results are shown in the solid lines, and the Medea results are shown in the dotted lines. So you can see that for most values of ionization, as well as for most of these different channels, the agreement is fairly good. The exception is perhaps this helium ionization channel. And the reason these results look so different is because Medea uses this discrete Monte Carlo-based method. It's going to be very bad at capturing particularly rare events like helium ionizations. Yes?
So what do you mean by helium ionization? Like which electron in helium?
This is probably, I would think, just the first ionization.
And what is the y-axis
here? Oh, so the R sub C's is how much energy gets deposited into a particular channel. So if you divide by the electron's initial energy, it's the fraction of the electron's energy that gets deposited. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes.
So on a more basic level, so you're solving a set of Boltzmann equations for the populations of photons and electrons, including this extra effect, or could you tell me like the
I'll get to the equations in like maybe the next slide. Is that okay? Okay. And then you can let me know if it's still unclear then. Yeah.
Sorry, what is the continuum component?
For the continuum, we refer, in this case, the continuum refers to photons with energy less than 10.2 eV, or the Lyman alpha transition, because in the original version of our code, these photons were considered just free stream. So they're a lost channel, in a sense.
In the previous plot, the lowest energy you showed was like 14
eV? Sorry, where? This one?
Yeah.
Yes.
Where is it? Continuum 10 eV is included? How?
Likely in secondary, secondary spectra. Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Good. So I was just making the point that the Medea line is quite noisy for helium because this is a rare channel, and so. In a sense, I think this is another check that like our new high energy treatment is in some ways better than Medea. Okay, so now let me talk a little bit about the changes we made to the hydrogen treatment. So previously in dark history, we used what was called the three-level atom or TLA approximation. So the assumptions that go into the three-level atom are that the background radiation is perfectly black body, and also that all energy levels of hydrogen above n equals 2 are in perfect thermal equilibrium. So that means that there's only three levels we really have to keep track of: the ground state, the first excited state, and this higher continuum level. So you can show that under these assumptions, you can write down a set of coupled temperature and ionization equations. And so this is what we solve in dark history to keep track of background temperature and ionization, but including source terms that capture the effect of this exotic energy injection. So for those of you who are familiar with recombination codes, this is pretty similar to what RecFast does, but with the addition of these exotic energy injection terms. However, if we want to track things like radiation, in particular radiation coming from atomic transitions, then just tracking three levels might not be enough, right? We want something that's a little bit more sophisticated than this. So in dark history version 2, we generalized this to the multi-level atom, or MLA treatment for short. So in the MLA treatment, what we do is we now track levels up to some user-specified maximum energy level. Let's call it nmax. And you can show that under these assumptions, you get an altered set of equations, in particular, an altered ionization equation, where previously you had the photoionization and recombination coefficients. These are now some effective coefficients that depend on the occupation of all of these higher levels that you are keeping track of. OK, so now that we have the MLA treatment, we can do some comparisons to the TLA and see in which regimes the MLA was necessary. So for example, here I show the occupation number of the first few excited states of hydrogen as a function of redshift. And then the TLA results are in the solid line. And then the MLA results tracking up to 100 energy levels are shown in these dotted lines here. So you can see that the agreement is really good at these early redshifts. However, there start to be some discrepancies as you move to lower redshifts and the assumptions that go into the TLA become less valid. So by the time we reach redshifts of like 10, you can see that for the 2s level, this disagreement is larger than an order of magnitude. So that's why the TLA wasn't quite good enough for what we wanted to do.
What's the reason for this redshift dependence?
Like why the occupation numbers evolve as a function of time?
Yeah, or why the assumptions are less valid at lower redshift.
Oh, it's because we can look at one of the assumptions, like background radiation is perfectly black body. As you move to later in redshifts, you start to accumulate these spectral distortions, and it's at late enough redshifts, it becomes harder for the CMB to at late enough redshifts, it becomes harder for the CMB to rethermalize and become a perfect black body. So that's one of the assumptions that's broken. Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Good. So we can also see what happens to the MLA as we include more and more hydrogen levels. So you can see the ionization history now. This is the free electron fraction as a function of redshifts on the top panel. And for comparison, we show results to another recombination code called HIREC, which also uses the MLA method, but without this exotic energy injection. And so then the bottom panel here shows the difference between our results and HIREC. So you can see that as we start at tracking just 10 energy levels and we move to 200, this ionization history converges towards the HIREC result, such that by the time we reach 200 energy levels, the differences are at the level of a few percent or smaller. The reason those discrepancies are there is simply because there are certain percent level effects that are included in HIREC that we chose not to include because we didn't need percent level precision for studying exotic energy injection. Good, so we found reasonable agreement with HIREC. As you might have guessed, more levels takes more time to compute. If you don't need to get the ionization history correct at this level, at the percent level, and you can track just 10 energy levels, then dark history takes maybe minutes to run on a laptop, minutes or less. But if you really need the full machinery, if you need to go to 200 hydrogen levels, it can take as much as hours with our code. Good. So that's all the description of the methods. Do people have further questions before I move into the applications? Great, okay. All right, so let me start by talking about this. Oh, sorry, before I go into the first application, I wanted to talk a little bit about previous ways in which dark history was used to give you a little bit of context for what has been done and what's going to be new. So as I mentioned, using dark history version 1 and its precursors, you could calculate how the universe's temperature and ionization changed in the presence of decaying or annihilating dark matter or other forms of exotic energy injection. So for example, if you modify the ionization history of our universe, you're going to change the CMB power spectrum that you get. And so you can use this to set constraints on exotic energy injection by looking at the CMB anisotropy spectrum. So this is work that has been done. I show one particular study here, but there are many studies that have done these sorts of constraints. And then if you look at heating, you can infer the matter temperature of the universe by looking at things like the Lyman alpha forest, and then also use this to set constraints on exotic heating. So this was work that we did a few years ago, and here I show the constraint that we get on dark matter decaying to E plus E minus pairs. Okay, but so these were old applications, and now that we have the photon spectra, we can start to look at completely new applications of dark history, for example, by looking at these CMB spectral distortions. All right, so what do I mean by these spectral distortions? So about 30 years ago now, Kobe Fires showed us that the CMB is very close to a perfect black body. You can see their data here. This is intensity as a function of frequency. And you see that data is very beautifully fit by a black body of about 2.7 Kelvin. So now, if there's any addition or subtraction of energy from the photon bath that makes up the CMB, and for some reason these photons cannot fully rethermalize, then we would expect the spectrum to be distorted away from that of a black body. And now, the distortions have to be very small, because if we look closely at this plot, you'll see that the error bars have been blown up by 400 times so that we can even visualize them on this slide. So that tells you that distortions have to be less than about 1 part in 10 to the 4 in terms of intensity. But I think this is still an interesting time to think about spectral distortions because, in principle, we have the technology today to get at spectral distortions to 1 part in 10 to the 8. So I think it's kind of an interesting time to ask, okay, then in addition to what are standard signals we might expect from CMB spectral distortions, what are beyond standard model predictions for these signals? OK, So what are the ways in which we could form a spectral distortion? So here I'm flashing up some of the important processes that we talked about that are present in the early universe. So you can see that one easy way to get a spectral distortion is you have these energetic electrons scattering against CMB photons, right? So the way this scattering happens is going to be controlled by how energetic or hot these electrons are. So heat is also going to be something that's important. And then you can also see that we can get these extra photons from these atomic transitions here. So those are the things that we'll have to keep track of, or we'll have to keep in mind when thinking about how to calculate these spectral distortions. Okay, so here is a slide, or here's a plot from the ESA Voyage 2050 white paper on spectral distortions, showing you some of the expected signals just from vanilla lambda CDM cosmology. So here now on the y-axis, we have the intensity relative to the CMB, so this is truly the spectral distortion. And you can see the error bars that I showed earlier in these blue dots here. So the largest contribution we would expect is this solid line here. So this comes from CMB photons getting upscattered by electrons in galaxy clusters. For the cosmologist, this is also known as the Thermal-Sanyeev-Zeldovich effect. And then another signal I wanted to point out is this one at the bottom, this dashed line here. So this is an interesting one. This comes from atomic lines that are emitted around the time of recombination. So this is a pretty well-studied feature, or this is a pretty well-studied signal because you can see it has many, many more features compared to some of these other signals. So in a sense, that makes it in some ways easier to search for. And another reason that signal is interesting is because it allows us to show that all the new atomic physics we put into dark history works very beautifully. So here I'm showing the dark history results for those atomic lines at recombination, calculated using a different number of energy levels. And we're comparing the results to results from the literature. So you can see that across this range of frequencies, we match these signals pretty well. There are some small discrepancies, about percent level or less, likely due to those percent level effects that I mentioned we didn't need to include for dark history. But in general, we produce all the right peaks and troughs. So this is a nice cross-check that, yes, everything that we put into dark history makes sense.
Previous plot, that heat TSC contribution, is the amplitude of set to avoid the fire-s constraints?
So I think actually this is just the prediction for the size of the thermal SC effect you might get from galaxy clusters. Yeah, so it's just under the limits. Okay, so that's all the standard cosmology ways to get a spectral distortion. Now let's see what happens if we throw exotic energy injection into the mix. So this is an example of a spectral distortion as calculated by dark history in this magenta line here. So the negative, sorry, the dashed lines just indicate negative values of the spectral distortion, so where photons have been subtracted relative to the CMB. Good, so this is for a model of dark matter that decays to E plus C minus pairs at a mass of about half of a GeV, and then the lifetime is chosen to be at the limit of what is allowed by those CMB anisotropy constraints. So also for scale, I'm showing you the CMB blackbody spectrum, but scaled down by a factor of about 10 to the 4, so you get a sense of where constraints on spectral distortions are. One other thing I should mention is that in this magenta line, I'm not including those standard cosmology contributions that I mentioned earlier. In other words, I can run dark history with and without exotic energy injection, and I'm taking the difference of the spectral distortion, so this shows you purely the contribution from including that decaying and annihilating dark matter. Okay, so now that we get all that, I can now show you the spectral distortions we would get from an array of different models. So here are examples of a bunch of spectral distortions, all for dark matter decaying to E plus E minus pairs, but at different masses, and again with the lifetime chosen to be at current CMB limits. So in our paper, we also show a number of other channels, for example, decay to photons or for annihilations. But we found that the signals were largest for decay to E plus E minus pairs, large enough that a future experiment such as PIXI, which I sort of alluded to earlier, could start to get at some of these spectral distortions if we get a future spectral distortions probe like this off the ground. So that's cool because this tells us that these future experiments could start to tell us a little bit more about what is the allowed or constrained parameter space for dark matter. I saw a hand.
Yeah, sorry. You, mm-hmm. you said this is just a VSM contribution. So
yes.
How does it compare, like the percent level to the thermal SC?
Yeah. So let's see. So if we look at this plot, the thermal SC effect was maybe just under the CMB limits, right? So here, we're finding our signals are maybe two orders of magnitude less than that, so maybe percent to tens of percent. Yeah.
Does it look significantly different from the community, or is the shape kind of similar?
Yeah, so is that something that we have to follow up on a bit more? We haven't done any studies to quantify exactly how degenerate these signals are with predicted signals. You can see that some of these features are similar, like this trough peak signal here looks pretty similar to the Y distortion you get from the SC effect. But you can see that at these higher energies, we get a lot of interesting features that would be more a smoking gun of injection of high energy particles. And then the question is, like, how detectable are these high energy photons? Yeah, so that's something that we have to follow up on a bit more.
Sorry, but the high energy part, it's, you're saying the features are because of like lines, right? Or
not just the lines, but just injecting high energy particles that are cooling. So then all of these photons come from not just the atomic lines, which give you these bumps here, but like, I don't know, inverse Compton scattering, other cooling processes that give you these bigger shoulders here. Other questions about spectral distortions? Okay, so let me now start on the second application, which was looking at CMB anisotropy constraints. So I talked a little bit about this earlier. If you have these exotic ionizations, then you have more free electrons around that can scatter the CMB photons, and so this will overall lead to a damping of the CMB power spectrum. So I put up this plot here because this shows you that this is the primary effect for a bunch of different dark matter models. So here we show, in these colorful lines here, they included the effects of dark matter annihilating to different final states. And you can see that the effect is always just to damp the CMB as a whole. So you can use this to constrain energy injection by dark matter. And so on this plot now, I've shown constraints from a couple of different studies. So this is the lifetime for dark matter decaying to photons versus the dark matter mass. And you can see that for all of these, both of these studies, the constraints cut off at a mass of about 10 keV. And so the reason for that was because of what I mentioned earlier, there were some uncertainties in the calculation of low energy deposition, such that we just didn't really trust the results for those low masses and low injection energies. However, because of our upgrades, we can now extend these constraints to arbitrarily low masses. And so we've done an estimate for what that constraint would look like, and that's what's shown in this red contour here. So you can see that we have a constraint down to about tens of EV, and then there's this sharp cutoff here. That's because at that mass, the primary photons that you get from this decay, their energy drops below the hydrogen ionization threshold, so you no longer get your primary effect on the CMB. And so the constraint kind of dies away. Another thing we can ask is, OK, since we have this estimate for what the constraint would look like with all of our nice new upgrades, how bad or good was the old code really? And so if you squint a little bit, you might be able to see this black dashed line here. And so this is the constraint that we estimate using dark history version 1, so before we have all the upgrades. And you can see that although there are some like kinks, some jaggedness here at low masses, likely due to those interpolation errors that I talked about, overall, the shape of this constraint is pretty good, pretty well matches what we would get with the new code. So that means for this particular application, and looking at how exotic ionization affects the CMB constraint, you probably don't need all the machinery of dark history of version 2, and version 1 would be sufficient for the study that you're interested in. OK. Now, if you're interested in axions or axion-like particles, we can also translate our constraint on the lifetime into a constraint on the axion-photon coupling. So that's what I'm showing here. The black contour is our results, and we're showing the results from a bunch of other probes in these colorful lines. So you can see that while our constraint may not be the strongest, it's fairly competitive with some of these other probes. And then I should also mention that we coordinated with another group to release these results at the same time. They also looked at the constraint on the axion-photon coupling, but our results are a little bit complementary. What I mean by that is, as I've been saying, to calculate, to do our constraint, we use this simple estimate based on previous principal component analyses that other people have done, whereas in this study, what this group did was the full MCMC to really robustly determine where this constraint is located. However, they used Dark History version 1, and they didn't have all the improvements that we did. But so then, by releasing our results together, we were able to show that even if they had access to Dark History version 2, their constraints likely wouldn't change by much. So in that sense, it was kind of nice to be able to work together to put these out at the same time. And we are currently verifying this with a very talented undergraduate, Clara Xu, as well as investigating exactly how suppressed the CMB bounds become once we drop below the hydrogen ionization threshold. Okay, so that's the work we did on the CMB power spectrum. And so this brings me to the last application, which I'm going to spend a little bit of extra time on since it's the most recent stuff that I've done. And so this is looking at how exotic energy injection impacts the formation of early stars. So if we think about how exactly stars form, usually what happens today is you have some gas cloud sitting out there, and it's enriched with metals. And these metals help it to cool and therefore collapse, and then you get a star. It's a bit of a simplified picture, but that's generally how it works. However, for the very earliest stars, the gas has not yet been enriched with metals because star formation hasn't happened yet, right? So that means that the only stuff we have around is basically hydrogen and helium. So the most important coolant for the very earliest stars is what is called molecular hydrogen, or H2 for short. So I've listed some of the most important reaction rates for forming H2 here. And you can see that these reaction rates depend on quantities such as what is the temperature of the gas, what is the level of ionization, since you need free electrons as a catalyst to form H2, and then also what is the spectrum of background radiation, since photons at the right energies can either dissociate the H2 itself or key intermediate states for forming the hydrogen or molecular hydrogen. So given that experiments such as HERA, which is a 21-centimeter interferometer, as well as James Webb, are starting to tell us a little bit more about this early stage of star formation, I think it's kind of interesting to ask, okay, again, how will exotic energy injection change this picture? Could these new experiments tell us anything more about dark matter? All right, so let me talk a little bit more about how we calculate the effect, or how we parameterize the effect of exotic energy injection on star formation. We're going to do this in a relatively simple way, since this is an initial study of how of the effect of exotic energy injection. We're going to treat the gas as a spherical top hat, in other words, just some ball of uniform density. And so the first thing that has to happen is an initial overdensity has to collapse and virialize to form a halo. And so this is how this process is just depends on the like kinetic energy of the particles you have countering the gravity that's pulling all these particles together. But then after your halo has virialized, you need the baryons to continue collapsing in order to eventually collapse into stars, right? So the baryons have to be able to further dissipate their kinetic energy in some way. And so how well they do that is going to depend on quantities, on processes such as exotic heating versus this molecular hydrogen cooling. So typically what happens is for smaller halos, as they collapse, they become pressure supported and are not very efficient at cooling. And so you tend to end up with this puffy gas thing that doesn't form a whole lot of stars. But if you move to larger halos, generally this cooling wins and you get this runaway collapse. So the gas is able to rapidly cool and then fragment. And then you get star formation. So that means that there is some critical halo mass above which we expect most halos to be able to collapse and form stars in this way, and below which we expect these halos to stay puffy and not do a whole lot of anything. And so then the question becomes, how does dark matter energy injection affect this value? Could it in fact raise this threshold or lower it? I guess I should mention this gray contour here is that mass threshold calculated using the default cosmology in dark history. And you can see that it changes as a function of redshift. And so then we want to know that what happens if we turn on exotic energy injection in dark history? How is this line going to change? Okay, so we can get an idea of how this will change the mass threshold by looking at some of the effects I've mentioned one by one. So again, this is the mass threshold, but this is before we've put in any exotic energy injections. And now if I throw in this particular dark matter model, so this one decays to E plus E minus pairs at about 180 MeV, what happens if I just turn on the heating from this model? So if I turn on the heating, as I mentioned before, heat encounters this process of molecular cooling and tends to keep these halos puffier. So that means you're going to raise the mass threshold that you need for these halos to collapse. And so in fact, you get this red line here. If I instead just look at the effect of exotic ionizations, well, if you have these exotic ionizations, then you have more electrons around to catalyze the formation of molecular hydrogen. So you get more cooling. And in fact, exotic ionizations tend to lower this mass threshold and accelerate the process of star formation. So this is pretty interesting because you can already see that just within this one model, there are competing effects. And so it's actually not very clear in the end whether the net effect will be to raise or lower this mass threshold. It's non-trivial to determine. Okay, so we also I also want to talk a little bit about the effect of radiation. So as I mentioned, there are two main ways that radiation can change the star formation process. It can dissociate this intermediate H minus state. However, for this particular model, we find that this is a very small effect. It just gives you this dotted line here, which barely raises the threshold. The more important effect is what we call the Lyman-Werner background. And these are photons at the right energy to dissociate the H2 itself. So you can see, if you include this Lyman-Werner background, you can raise the threshold up to this pink dotted line. So the effect is comparable to heating. There's a bit of a caveat on this effect because the astrophysics surrounding the Lyman-Werner background, its effect on star formation is still a little bit uncertain. That's because there's a possibility that these early halos can shield themselves from the Lyman-Werner background. In other words, the outer parts of the halo absorb all the important radiation, but the core of the halo is still able to collapse unaffected. So simulation studies still give somewhat differing results on how important this background is. But instead of taking a guess at what the right amount of self-shielding is, we're going to try and bracket this effect, by which I mean we will either say self-shielding is super efficient so that the Lyman-Werner background doesn't matter at all and we don't consider its effect, or we say self-shielding is totally inefficient, and so the core of the halo feels the full brunt of the Lyman-Werner background, and you get the full effects giving you this pink line.
Just so I understand the plot, each one of these lines is if I do no exotic energy injections, then I add dark matter causing each one of these effects individually, but not all together.
Right, yeah, so I'm isolating the effects.
Yeah. I'm also confused. You said that your code below some energies for the photons, it treated the photons as free screening, but now you're adding molecular hydrogen. Is that included in your code, the absorption of the low energy photons in molecular hydrogen?
So the abundance of molecular hydrogen in the universe is pretty tiny. It's very tiny, yeah. So the effect on the background spectrum of radiation is going to be fairly small.
That's small, but then after you start forming these clouds of molecular hydrogen, does it matter that your code doesn't include the absorption of the low energy photons in those?
You're saying like below the 10.2, maybe I'm a little confused. So you're asking...
You were saying that in your code, 10 electron volt photons is pre-stream, right?
That was in the old version of the code. In the new version of the code, we track the spectrum as a whole.
Okay, including...
Yeah, including below 10.2.
Okay.
Yeah.
But for the monopole, though, presumably that effect is small, right? Because, you know, the covering fraction of these tiny halos is tiny.
Yeah.
Yes, but she wants to study, I guess, the evolution of the molecular hydrogen in those halos to study the effectiveness of star formation. And then those photons, then I guess it matters if those photons get absorbed there because that will affect star formation there. And that's included.
Yeah, the halos, yeah, for sure. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you were asking about
the background.
No,
I'm asking if they're interested in the small.
Okay. Okay, so that was the discussion of the photons. And now let's see what happens if we add up all these effects. So if you add up all the effects, what you get is this gold band here, where the thickness of the band parameterize brackets the effect of that Lyman-Werner radiation that I talked about. So you can see that at very early redshifts, the main effect is to lower the mass threshold for collapse. But these aren't really the relevant redshifts for star formation, right? We want to look at redshifts of 20 to 30, where in fact the mass threshold has been raised. Good. So we can, So we can see that there's this kind of rich interplay of different effects, and you have to track all of them in order to be able to determine what is the net effect on this threshold. Does it get raised or does it get lowered? No, we evolve the density. So since it's a top hat halo, you can solve for the evolution of the density inside a top hat halo. There are these equations that determine how the radius of this top hat halo changes as a function of redshift and mass. Yeah, things like that.
Inside the top hat, though, is constant density.
Oh yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also, what's observable is not this quantity. The only thing that we know is that in the end there were some metals to form main sequence stars.
Uh-huh.
So what if you change this value? Is that observable in any way? The only thing that we want is a few metals to form main sequence stars, right?
So again, we're talking about pop three stars.
Exactly.
Here.
So the top three requirement, the only reason why we need them is because we need metals, right? Form main sequence stars. the variety that you'll see that JWST is
zero. Right, so I mentioned JWST earlier, but the observable I'm going to focus on at the very end is 21 centimeter. I'll toggle,
Okay, you're
mm-hmm.
going for 21 centimeter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I'll come back to that at the very end. Yes.
Sorry.
No, sorry.
maybe one thing for you is going to be, it's still not quite 100% clear to me.
Mm-hmm. Let me think. So, I mean, the influx of E plus E minus, we do take that into account because you can have exotic ionizations and also these secondary electrons that are produced. I guess I should specify the way in which we're looking at exotic energy injection. Dark history looks at the homogeneous components of dark matter energy injection. So background. So everything is background. And so we're looking at if you have this background change to ionization, to radiation, and all of this stuff radiates your halo, how does that change star formation? There could be something from, we only account for the enhanced density of the halo in how this changes energy deposition. We're not necessarily accounting for decays and annihilations due to the enhanced density itself. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Good. Any more questions about this particular plot? Okay. So this all shows you the effect from one particular model of decaying dark matter, right? This is dark matter decaying to E plus E minus at a certain mass at a certain lifetime. And so what we want to know is what does this effect look like across a broad range of dark matter models. So this is, I'll show you the results on here for a second, but let me just explain a few things so we're on the same page. This is the parameter space for dark matter that decays to E plus E minus pairs. Again, we have the decay lifetime here and the mass on the x-axis. So the gray contour here shows you the parameter space that is already ruled out by the CMB power spectrum constraints that I mentioned earlier. So what will be interesting is if we can get significant effects on the mass threshold for star formation far outside of these contours. OK, so this is now the relative change to the mass threshold specifically at a redshift of 20, since that's around when we expect these very first stars to be forming. So the red contours tell you where the mass threshold has been raised, and we would expect star formation to be delayed, whereas the blue parameter space is where star formation gets accelerated. So you can see that for the smallest lifetimes, in other words, where the injection rate of the exotic energy injection rate is relatively fast, the most important effect comes from the exotic heating, or maybe, yes, comes from the exotic heating, which tends to puff up these halos and thus delay star formation. And what's kind of interesting is as you move to longer lifetimes and reduce the amount of energy being injected, this effect doesn't just monotonically go to zero, right? You actually get this blue, this whole blue swath of parameter space, where in fact what matters most is these exotic ionizations that are giving you extra H2 and extra cooling. This is also under the assumption of very efficient self-shielding, so we're neglecting Lyman-Berman photons for the moment. Good, and so what's interesting is you can see a lot of this blue parameter space lies outside of current CMB constraints and even lies outside of direct detection constraints, which are shown in this green dot dashed line here. So this is for a redshift of 20, and I can also calculate what this contour plot would look like for any other redshift that you might be interested in. As you can see, the shape of these contours generally stays the same, but their height in this space, as well as their depths, changes depending on the redshift. But let's stick to 20 for now, since this is the epoch that we care about. I mentioned there were these astrophysical uncertainties from self-shielding. So what happens if we say that there is no self-shielding, and in fact there is a lot of this Lyman-Werner radiation irradiating these halos? So what happens is that as we go from efficient self-shielding to no self-shielding, well, you have extra Lyman-Werner photons to destroy H2 and prevent cooling. So you see that these red contours get pushed up a bit and eat up more of this parameter space. And then the depth of these blue contours is somewhat reduced. But it's still quite interesting that we get a significant amount of this blue parameter space outside of existing constraints, even with this extreme assumption of absolutely no self-shielding. So this tells us that this is probably around where we would expect to see the most interesting, these are the models that would have the most interesting effect on star formation. And so I highlight these two models, this one which is just not ruled out by constraints, and this one which is slightly ruled out, somewhat ruled out by constraints. I'm going to show you the effects of this on 21 centimeter in a second, just to highlight what that effect would look like in observables. Good. So you asked the question of how exactly would we observe these changes to the mass thresholds. So the probe that we think is probably the most promising is 21 centimeter cosmology. And so just as a brief review of what this is, 21 centimeter cosmology refers to radio telescopes that are looking for this hyperfine transition of neutral hydrogen. So this is a nice clean way of probing the epoch of reionization as well as cosmic dawn, since we have lots of neutral hydrogen around at this time. So we can predict what the signals from 21 centimeter cosmology would look like. So this was taken from a review paper. This is the brightness temperature, which is a proxy for the intensity of the 21 centimeter line as a function of redshifts or frequency. And you can see that there are a lot of peaks and troughs in this signal. And then the timing of these peaks and troughs depends on key events, such as when these first stars and galaxies turn on. So by messing with the mass threshold for star formation, and therefore messing with the timing of when these first stars turn on, we can also alter the timing of 21 centimeter signals. So using Julian Munoz's ZEUS21 code, we looked at this. So on the left here, we have the brightness temperature, so the global 21 centimeter signal as a function of redshift. And on the side, we have the power spectrum, specifically at a wave number of 0.2 inverse megaparsecs, also as a function of redshift. So the black solid line in the middle shows you what happens if we don't include any exotic energy injections. So this is kind of our lambda CDM curve. And then the blue and red contours show you the effect on the signal if I throw in those two fiducial models that I showed earlier on that parameter space. So for that model that was ruled out, the reason I chose to show this one is because that's an example of a model that delays star formation at this particular, at the redshift of 20. So you can see that this whole signal gets shifted towards lower redshifts later times. However, for the model that's just outside of current constraints, the blue one, or the Yeah, the one that's represented in this blue contour, you can see that the signal gets shifted in the opposite direction, such that the difference between these curves is a difference in redshift of about 2-ish. And so that means that if an experiment like HERA or some of these other 21 centimeter probes can make a signal of, or can make an observation of the power spectrum or global signal at these different redshifts, then maybe it could tell us a little bit more about the timing of when these first stars turned on, and therefore maybe tell us also a little bit more about how dark matter is or is not affecting these processes. However, to say anything more quantitative, we're going to have to move to hydrodynamical simulations, since actual star-forming halos aren't perfectly spherical or perfectly top hat, right? So that's something that we'd like to look towards in the future. So if anyone here is an expert in hydrosims, you know, I would love to chat. And so that brings me to the end of my talk. So yeah, just to summarize, we can look for exotic energy injection through how it affects a number of different cosmological observables. And so here I've talked about how it affects the CMB black body, how it affects the CMB power spectrum, as well as how dark matter can alter the first star formation and 21 centimeter signals. So some applications that we're looking to in the future, if you can alter how the first stars form, then maybe you can also affect the formation of early black holes. The black holes I'm talking about are not the kind that you would get from just stellar collapse, but these so-called direct collapse black holes that are hypothesized to maybe form the heavy seeds for the supermassive black holes that we see today. Couple other things I'm interested in that didn't really fit in with the theme of this talk. If anyone's interested in primordial black holes, how you form them, maybe from particular mollusk inflation, or developing analytic methods to study the 21 centimeter signal, these are a couple of my other interests. So as Katie said, I'll be around until Friday and I'm happy to chat more. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I have a very question. Mm-hmm. So how does the code scale same time as function of n?
Say again?
The computational cost, the time as a function of the n max of the...
Oh, as a function of how many levels we include? I don't know the exact scaling with n. I just know like roughly, I'm not sure exactly, yeah. All I can tell you is approximately how much time it would take given a particular n. I guess we could draw a line through that, but yeah. Yes?
So for the very first part of your talk, mm-hmm. where you were discussing the spectral distortion.
Yes.
Do you know how that tail, which seems to be in the infrared, if I remember, like at a terahertz? Where
the high energy tail. Yes.
I mean, we measure the cosmic infrared background very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know at those frequencies how flat is the SED of the cosmic infrared background. Like, does that look like that would seem to be the thing to worry about that looks most like your signal?
Good. So sorry, let me just pull up the relevant slide. So you were saying in like this tail?
Yeah. So after the CMB dies,
mm-hmm.
I don't know at, you know, terahertz frequencies what the SED of this cosmic infrared background is.
I'm not exactly sure either. To be honest, I would have to look that up. What I recall in discussions was that the primary concern here was whether the intensity at this level would be observable at all. That's something we're not entirely sure about. And so.
Because of those foregrounds or because of something else? Like Pixie has the sensitivity on your plot to get there. But,
right. Yeah. And maybe that's what causes the uptick at the end is those foregrounds. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so that paper, what they were doing to try to find the lines of the pure CMB, the standard model CMB,
mm-hmm.
and their conclusion was that
the signal is 6 or 20 would be below the cosmic infrared background.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
problem. Yes, so okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's right. Yeah, so although the tail is unique, the detectability is the problem. Yeah.
So for the first part, you said it's most relevant to dark matter decay.
Mm-hmm.
The star formation thing, is it also more interesting for dark matter decay?
Yeah, so for the star formation, we found that decays tend to be more interesting. So the reason decays are more important is because of how these scale with redshift. Annihilations scale more steeply with redshift because they go as density cubed.
Already from the
earlier redshifts.
Like the CMB.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the effect of ejected electron positrons at temperatures below 13.6 eV on these anisotropy signals. You did it,
okay.
Like I said, you're looking into this for future work. Is that just going to be more of like a thermal effect rather than?
Oh, you mean, yes, you mean like the what the constraint looks like below that sharp cutoff?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so so you don't get an effect on the CMB from direct ionizations by like these primary photons. So the question is like whether you can. There is still a constraint at all from like secondary ionizations and whatnot. So we're just with Clara, we're doing like an MCMC at least to start with a Fisher matrix analysis at these very low masses to see like how many orders of magnitude is this constraint suppressed by.
Secondary ionizations just being ionizations that aren't hydrogen, just like other elements. Or...
Yeah. So like, let's see if you have. Let me think. Yeah, you have, let's see, low energy photons. Potentially these could like excite the hydrogen and make it slightly easier to ionize. So yeah, I guess that's not exactly secondary ionizations. But basically ionizations that result as a result of these secondary cooling processes, anything like that. Yeah.
Let's thank once again and sign up for dinner tomorrow if you would like it. There's also many times.